You're listening to the Get Out and Drive podcast with John Custom Car Nerd Meyer and Jason Old Car Guy Carr. We'll be bringing you gearheads everything you never wanted to know about cars and why they should be on the road and not in your garage. Are you ready to get out and drive?
And welcome back to a blazingly fast episode of the Get Out and Drive podcast. I am John Custom Car Nerd Meyer.
And I'm Jason Old Car Guy Carr.
Jason, have you driven across the country? Have you driven across, I know you've driven across Canada. Have you driven across the United States? Like, you know, like shore to shore, have you driven that yet?
I'm ashamed to admit I've never even done it across Canada. I've flown it a few times, but never driven.
You've never driven across Canada?
No.
I mean, I can't even think how it would be as somebody who settled the West to drive in a wagon and try and explore the Louisiana Purchase from where I am in St. Louis all the way to the West Shore. Much less being able to do it now in a car. Just get in a car and you're on the East Coast and haul ass as fast as possible to the West Coast. I've never even driven across the country, much less do I know how fast a person could drive across the country.
What do you figure you and I could do that? Just, you know, we're on a time crunch. Mm-hmm. We need to make it to LA and just drive, what, 3-4 days maybe?
I would probably think it would be 3 or 4 days. I mean, I have to stop to pee. I mean, I have to get a hamburger. I have to do all sorts of things. I have a tiny gas tank in my car. There's 100 things that would keep me from going fast. I know a while back I ran into a man named Fred Ashmore, and I don't know how we tripped over each other on Facebook, but I've always been a fan of the movie Cannonball Run. I've always been a fan of watching and watching the Cannonball Run record from the Red Ball to, I think it's, I can't remember where it is. It's Santa Monica Pier. I think, but from sea to sea and watching the record from the Cannonball go on that route and get it shorter and shorter and shorter. And during 2020, there were very little policemen on the road. There was nobody on the road car wise. Everybody was on lockdown and everything. Well, Fred thought it was a great idea to get in his car and just break the record. Fred and I got to talking about things, and I asked him to get on our podcast, and amazing, he's on with us tonight. So welcome. Thanks for hanging out with us, Fred Ashmore.
Thanks for having me here, guys.
Fred, I heard you like to be record-breaking fast at certain things, like the Cannonball Run. So I thought we'd start this episode off with a segment we call Done in 60 Seconds.
Okay.
We want to get in the head of the man that broke the Cannonball Run record.
Sounds good to me. Let's go.
Okay, John, set the timer. Fred, the first question is, what's your favorite car movie?
Gumball Rally.
Second question, what's your favorite car rental agency?
Definitely Avis.
What's your fastest speed that you've ever driven?
204.
What's your favorite car to get out and drive?
My Mustang GT.
How many times have you driven the C2C?
7.
Your must-have food for a road trip?
Beef jerky.
The car you took your driver's license test in?
Ford Bronco 2.
eBay, Facebook Marketplace, or Racing Junk?
Definitely Marketplace.
What's the first car you've ever owned?
Ford Pinto.
And Back to the Future 1, 2, or 3?
Number 1, baby.
That's right. That's a classic. Now, I think it's time we get into this podcast.
Perfect.
Fred, kind of lead us into and tell us about how you got involved with Cannonball and how it led up to your 2555 record for C2C, which is your current, you are currently the fastest person to drive solo across the country. That's right.
That is 100% correct.
Okay. Kind of lead us in there.
And I hope you guys got time because it's a long story.
That's what we're here for, man.
You know, really, it all started with a used car sale online. I can't remember if it was Craigslist or Marketplace. back in late 2013, 14. Had a car online for sale. It was 1971 Mustang Boss 351. And a guy reached out from New Zealand and he just really liked Mustangs. We got talking a bit about him. Kind of different. You know, you don't always click with people from other countries or sometimes you think they're spamming you. But we just developed a relationship. And what I really didn't know is he was kind of vetting me. And then he popped the question and asked me if I'd be interested in participating in a cannonball style event that he was going to put on for, you know, pre-80 cars and things like that. And I was along for the ride. There had started out with being a whole bunch of people and then just came down to be three of us. My vehicle I was going to take malfunctioned the night I was leaving. So I had to go back home, pack up from Maine. I left late, drove from Maine to New York to California by myself nonstop. Well, I say nonstop, meaning I didn't stop and take rests or breaks or anything. I got in my truck 8 a.m. in Maine and drove to New York City to meet the guys who had already left by noon and drive across the country. And that was really my first, you know, soiling of the cannonball, you know, community to kind of, what would you say, initiation, because it was sort of punishment. It's not an easy drive, especially by yourself. And it was really interesting because there was a couple people that wanted to be there because they heard I was driving so far by myself. And to me, it wasn't unusual. I just figured if I didn't do it, I would kind of be letting the program down and, you know, not participating like I said I would. And it turned out to be addicting. And I wound up building the Galaxy, the 63 and a half. It's basically a street legal stock car. It has fiberglass fenders that I built. I made the buck. We made the fenders, made the hood, made the trunk. Has a Crown Vic front clip in it, 4.6 police interceptor engine. We put 200 gallons of gas in the back seat of it and showed up. And this really was where my pinnacle of cannonballing changed. I thought I was showing up as a very welcomed person. People wanted me there. And I was doing something that hadn't been done before, a nonstop run from New York to LA. Picked up a random guy for a co-pilot. And we took off across the United States in this, you know, 4,700-pound bomb. And, you know, things were going great. And we really felt good about everything. And I had some co-pilot issues. And it came down to the fact that my co-pilot hadn't done it before. He was very just nervous, sleep deprived. Once you get in, you really don't know what you're signing up for. So we got to the Portofino. We finished up. I came home, drove back by myself, and I planned on. So we made it. We're the first ones ever to make it nonstop in an event, which the Polish racing team tried to do back in the 70s. So we were able to accomplish that feat. And at the time, I was petitioned by the organizer doing a pre-65 run. And to my knowledge, that was something that they were putting out there for me to accomplish. So it was kind of a pre-65 record. We beat the other pre-65 car by like 3 hours. And we accomplished nonstop. So to me, it was just kind of a pat on my back. We did something that somebody hadn't done before. I really was racing as much as I could, but I also had the goal of making it nonstop. So it was a balance of or try to win and run out of fuel and not make it at all, or just try to break the nonstop. So we went with that route of the nonstop. And that's where my contributions to the cannonball world, we'll put it mildly, went to hell in a handbasket. So basically what it's told is you build a new car, you don't show up. So I did what they called, I built a bazooka to bring to a knife fight. Found a car down in Cocoa Beach, Florida. It was the Miami Vice TV show car. It was a 1979 Mustang wide body. And I said to myself, I'm going to go by the rules 100%. I'm going to build it for $3,000. And I am going to build the craziest $3,000 automobile you ever saw. And when I showed up, it was kind of like Larry Bird walking into the locker room during the 3-point shootout his second year, and looked in the locker room and was kind of like looking around seeing who was going to finish second. It wasn't a matter of if we were going to win or not. It was a matter of if we were going to break or not. And we went out with that car and blistered the USA. Travis Hilton, my brother, great, great team. And then again, we got across the finish line, record time. That was the pinnacle of me racing event races. And from there on out was when I decided I was going to go out and break the solo record. So that sums it up in a little bit. And the time in the Mustang was 31:47. And that was about 20 minutes faster than the other race records that were out there for the Cannonball route. So we felt pretty good about that. And just kind of a bunch of controversy started after that. And I decided that year I'm going to go out and do what I can to set as many records as I could in one run. And that's where the whole 25-55 run came from.
You know, Jason, we sure get to talk a lot.
Yes, and some of us more than others.
Who, me?
I'm not pointing any fingers.
Yes, you are. But we want to hear from our listeners. Just go to our website, getoutanddrive.com, scroll to the bottom of the page, and click the listener hotline button. We want to hear from you. Cool stories, breakdown stories.
Questions, comments.
Hate mail.
Even hate mail?
Even hate mail. You got a car show in your area? Let us know.
Tell us an interesting story.
Let us know what you like to get out and drive.
You had mentioned rules. And to my knowledge, there generally wasn't that many rules related to Cannonball. Maybe you can fill our listeners in on what some of those rules are to qualify a car for the Cannonball.
Well, the Cannonball rules, as Brock Yates established back in the 70s, was there's no rules. And that's the only rule in Cannonball is there's no rules. But when somebody like me shows up, all of a sudden the rules start coming out. And one of those things was safety. With the Galaxy, they were worried there's too much fuel in there, and they didn't get to vet my car and go over it. And they all didn't know who I was. And some of the guys had run in the 2904 before. And, you know, really just some of the people just started applying things that didn't necessarily matter. It was more to me on a personal level than it was, you know, my car. It was kind of like one of those things. Well, I'll beat him in the tech shack. Let's not sort it out on the racetrack type stuff. So the rule kind of came as there had been no accidents in Cannonball and they didn't want me to be the first one. So let's regulate him down and reel him in back to the rules. And probably the one rule that I could say was given was the car had to cost $3,000 or less to build or buy. And you could make improvements to it from there on out. But the car had to be 1980, older than 1980. And that was the rule. Older than 80, $3,000. And that's what it was. So when I went and got the Mustang I hauled off for junk. And I hauled it to Maine. And then I bought a 2000 Cobra, stripped the Cobra out, sold the Cobra body, kept the parts, bought an Aviator for the engine out, put everything together, built it in my garage. I think when we got done, the whole cost of the car was like $2,700 or something from selling the parts from the cars that I bought to build the car. So that whole Cannonball car was built for like $2,700 out of pocket. And that's painting it. That's all the letters. That's, you know, the whole ball of wax. So those are really the two rules that were there. But I started realizing that, as you said, there's no rules in Cannonball, but it all depends on who's cannonballing, if there's rules or not. So,
do you think the fact that you were bootstrap grassroots kind of guy, you think that's kind of detrimental to how people feel about you?
I really think that's a lot to do with me. A lot of people like to say that they're, you know, bootstraps, you know, put their pants on one leg at a time. Guys, I don't have a lot of money. It's how I use my money. I use my money wisely in the areas that my expertise aren't. And my thing is, when I walk out to that garage right out there, I've done what everybody said I can't do. I went out and built a car in my commercial shop back home. moved out here to Oklahoma, I work on the floor with jacks and jack stands just to prove people to people I don't need a commercial shop to beat them. That I think you're 100% correct. That's really what Chats amasses when Fred shows up to compete, because it started out as the, oh, well, you know, you're the guy that's got a commercial garage. You're the guy that's, you know, you got all the tools, you got this. And I said, oh, okay. So I'll go build one on the floor out here. And not only that, I'll build it in 30 days. So I have to agree 100%. My dad really raised me in the sense that rely on nobody but yourself to do things. And he's an amazing guy. He's down here right now in Oklahoma visiting. And I really got that from him. If you want something done, do it yourself. If you can find somebody else to blame it on, then you had time to do it anyway. They really look at me and they're like, how do you get so much done in one day? And there's days where I think I'm lazy and my wife will be like, you've done more in a day than most people do in a week. The talk is about what I do rather than what they could accomplish if they just spent the same time working as they did talking.
You know, looking back at some of the, not just the movies that Hollywood has kind of editorialized for the Cannonball Run, but looking back at a lot of the documentaries that are out there and the stories that people are telling, it seems to me the people that do, the type of people that do the Cannonball Run, it seems to be a little bit of a all boys club or a there's a certain elite, a type of person. I don't even know what that looks like, but maybe it's money, maybe it's influence or whatever it happens to be that seems to do that. And then along comes young Fred Ashmore from Maine, who's just going to go and take the bull by the, you know, what's and just do it his way. And all of a sudden, because he's not a part of that club, they don't like it. So first off, I commend you for stepping up to the plate and doing what you're doing and showing up those guys who have put so much more time, effort, and energy into it when it comes to doing that. Now, you said your dad was down there with you, and I always like to find out a little bit about, you know, where does the influence come from to some of these people that we interview? And I think based on what I know, your dad has been a big part of that. Tell us a little bit about your dad and his support for you with what you're doing with, you know, with these cannonball runs and everything that you've done.
So first of all, I want to thank you for calling me young, because I don't necessarily call myself young, even amongst the guys that I cannonball with. I'm 47, be 48 this year. But my dad from day one, I can tell you stories before I was in grammar school of foolish things that I always tell the story about the pumpkin, where I was out in the garage, just a little boy, and was out helping my dad. We didn't have a family truck, so he was building one. And he needed parts in town. He worked as a mechanic at the local body shop and straightened frames. And one Saturday around Halloween time, my dad says, hey, JR, he calls me JR because his name's Fred also. And he says, please remind me to measure the pumpkin before we go to town and get parts, because we only can go to town once because we don't have a lot of time. So I walk in across the batten boards that are over the mud puddle between our little driveway and our house, and walk into the house. And I say to my mom, I said, I need the pumpkin. And she says, the pumpkin? And I think I'm being helpful. I am a kid, less, not even in grammar school. So we're talking 3-4 years old walking around. And my mom looks at me and I said, Dad said he needs the pumpkin. My mom looks at me and she trusted me. She had no idea why a 3 or 4 year old's asking for a pumpkin. So she grabs it. And of course, you know, when you're that size, a pumpkin seems like it's this big. And here I am, kid, wrestling out through the door, and she opens the door and I walk out. And my dad looks at me with this quizzical look and he's like, what on earth are you doing with the pumpkin out here? And I said, you said you needed to measure the pumpkin before we go to town. Well, I didn't know what pumpkin was. Pumpkin was something you made a jack-o'-lantern out of. So he looked at me and he laughed. And he that's when he, you know, started understanding that I was retaining knowledge at a very young age. And I'm sure he either made me take the pumpkin back in the house, but that's one of the youngest stories I have about working with my dad. People always try to tell the story, oh, I cut my teeth on a wrench, you know, whatever kind of foolishness. But I can tell stories of, you know, pre grammar school out in the garage with my dad, helping him do stuff I grew up around Fords, and I was kind of a Ford kid. And my dad finally told me, he said, you know, you need to understand, if you're going to like cars, you have to like every car, you know, for what it is. Each car has their, you know, contribution. And so that influence with him broadened my horizon, and it broadened my horizon in a way that it opened my brain up, that, you know, with all these cars out there, what was going to be my big influence as far as what I was going to do with it down the road? And as my time went with him, and we wound up building the family shop when I was 12, and, you know, we built it. I mean, we dug the hole, we built the forms, we poured the concrete. We didn't have the money to hire anybody. So my influence with my dad goes way beyond cars. And that's how I wound up on the working for HGTV. Was when I applied for that job, it was from a random guy I knew, and I was like, hey, I'd like to put my hat in the ring. And the guy's like, Fred, you know, come on, you know, it's, you're a car guy. And I'm like, no, I can build houses. And he's like, okay, come on down. So I went down, and I was actually the first person hired for the show. And he was blown away when I went to the show that we put out a product better than everybody else. He's like, how is this possible? And he said, my dad taught me how to do everything. And if you wait on somebody, you could be doing it yourself. And that was my whole motto to life. You know, if you have time to wait for somebody, you have time to do it yourself. If you have time to do it over, you had time to do it right to start with. And that's where he really instilled in me. And he talked to me the other day. He said, you know, he goes, I do all these projects and I never get them done. And I looked at him and I said, Dad, you were never here to get a project done. He looks at me kind of funny. I said, I was here, put here to finish your projects. And he kind of laughed. I said, you don't like finishing out. I said, you work on them to a point and then you get tired of it. And I said, your mind is moved on to something else. I said, so I can finish them, then your project's done. And him and I work so well together, and we know what each other's thinking. As he's got older and as I've got older, obviously that balance has changed. But the influence he's had so much over me is the can-do attitude, which is a CB. He was in the military for 30 years, a CB. And it was a can-do attitude. And he instilled that in me at a young age. And I have always wanted to be the best at whatever I do, because if you're not trying to be the best, then why are you doing it? So maybe that sums it up. Maybe it doesn't. As far as the cannonball and the racing, my dad told me a lesson a long time ago. He said, everybody who gets out and drives should have a motorcycle license for their first year. And he looked directly at me and he pointed at me and he said, and you need to stay off of them. So he knew that there was a little firecracker inside of me, but he knew if I got on a motorcycle, I probably wouldn't be here giving this podcast. But that got me into stock car racing, calmed me down, got me off street racing. And as I got older and Top Fuel raced around the country, and I raced on dirt, asphalt, ice. And the cannonball just kind of fell into my elder years of being able to do something I can do by myself and not have to have a crew, not have to have a ton of help, and just have the can-do attitude. Well, if you can do it, I can do it. And that's really his biggest influence has been on me.
But what year was that? Briefly about being on HGTV.
So I got hired in HGTV January of 2020 before my record run, and it was completely on a whim of just saying yes. You know, I was told, yeah, Fred, you know, I don't know if this is for you, and I pushed. I'm like, well, let me give it a shot. Worst case scenarios, they're going to say no, we don't want you, or I'm not going to live up to your expectations. When we went to film the first show, they canceled 20 minutes before I pulled in the driveway. COVID hit
Wow.
on my way to Gulf Shores to film. I had hauled down from Maine with my camper, so they put the show off and we wound up filming the next year. And then that fall, I was hired by Street Outlaws. And I built all the cars for Farm Truck and Asian on the show with Jeff Lutz and Ed. And that morphed into another show. And then we filmed the first season of Battle on the Beach next spring, did the Street Outlaw gig, and we just filmed another TV show last November. So just kind of, you know, rolling with the punches, you know, as things go. The TV part of it is great. It helps, you know, pad the bank account in between, you know, the foolishness of driving across the USA or chasing old cars. But, you know, I've had a lot of good things happen to me since my initial interview back in January 2020. And right now I'm under a shopping contract with a company for my own show. So that stuff's all great. And I'm one of those guys. I do whatever I can to make things happen. And if it doesn't happen, I just move on to the next thing.
The Get Out and Drive podcast has partnered with RacingJunk.com to offer a pro club membership exclusively for our listeners for just $25 a year.
Just a few perks of the Pro Club membership include up to 50 free photos per ad, a dashboard to keep track of your listed items, and search alerts so you don't miss out on that must-have part.
Don't forget about the Racing Junk store discount. Free video uploads for your ads, $65 in ad upgrade credits, and an official club member banner on your ads.
Just use promo code POD23 when you sign up on racingjunk.com. So, Fred, you and I, you had mentioned your age. You and I are the same age. I called you young fella because I like being called young. I want to know who is Fred Ashmore? Who is, like, how did you get to where you are today? Let's go back 25 years, 30 years ago. You're just getting out of high school. You're starting to pursue a career in what? Where did you start? What brought you to where you are today?
That's probably one of the toughest questions, because I think when we all get out of school, especially where I grew up, I grew up in Maine. I'm not sure if a lot of the listeners know that. I grew up and was born and raised in Maine and lived there for the most part until I was in my early 40s. And Maine is a lifestyle. It is not for everybody. Everybody's really out for themselves, meaning, you know, you've got to figure it out for yourself because people aren't going to stand there and do it for you. So when I graduated high school, I had made the mistake of concentrating on more friends than my grades. And I still graduated, you know, close with honors and stuff, but I didn't have the grades that I should have had. And I had planned on going to GMI engineering school in Flint, Michigan. However, because I didn't pay as much attention to my grades, I kind of let that dream slip away. But I always say things happen for a reason. And for some reason, that wasn't the path I was supposed to take, because I didn't do what I needed to get there. I mean, that's my fault. That's on me. I don't blame anybody. I had a really odd childhood. I never missed a day of school in my entire life. So never, ever was I late, tardy, missed a day, was sick. And that's grammar school, high school, college. So never in all those years did I miss school. I was an active Eagle Scout. My dad was a Boy Scout, so I was an Eagle Scout. Was a varsity in four sports. And just had that drive to try to do everything. And then you walk across the stage and they go, "Congratulations, world's yours." And you're just standing there. I don't know how to balance a checkbook. I don't know how to save for my future. And I just took a job locally. I worked in the shop some, and a friend of mine knew I was a good ranch. He hired me. And then I decided, one of my buddies talked about going to college in Laramie. And I signed up and signed my life away at 23.6% interest, got a student loan and went to Laramie, which really was an eye opener for me. I didn't have money. The kids that I went to school with were pretty well off. I was in a dorm room and I couldn't afford anything. I thought I could get a job there. And unfortunately they would not hire kids that went to that school due to issues that they had with the school. So I thought I could get a job and I couldn't. So strangely enough, everybody talks about ramen noodles. I couldn't afford ramen noodles. I sold parts, swapped and traded and sold parts and did kids' homework. And I ate vanilla cake the whole time I was in college. I would bake a cake in the oven. I'd have all the ingredients and that's what I would eat. I would eat two or three pieces of cake a day. That's how I made it through college. And I rebuilt my motor to my truck that broke on the way out there. They wouldn't let me work on it in school. I rebuilt it in the back of a 57 Chevy panel truck in the middle of the driveway and put it all back together. And my dad flew out and I graduated fourth or fifth in my class. It was an interesting experience, but it was eye-opening because it really kind of told me who my friends were and who my friends weren't. And I walked to school sometimes. I walked in Laramie. And then when you say you walked in the winter uphill both ways, it was about 5 miles to school. And I would walk in the snow to school and I would still get there on time. I had got accolades for, you know, perfect attendance. I was class student. I didn't graduate top of my class, unfortunately, because I had been in the field long enough where always or never wasn't an option. I knew of options. So I'd challenge a teacher and they'd say, well, you know, you're right. We'll give you credit for that. But the material says this. And then you'd have six or seven other kids go, well, I got it wrong too. So I should get credit. And they're like, no, he has the experience and he can give us an example. So I didn't graduate top of my class, just a very eye-opening experience. I came back and went into the dealership world, thought I was going to be, you know, the next big tech, get the big money. And unfortunately, I fell right in the same hole my dad did in the military. I had too much knowledge, too much hands-on ability, and they wouldn't send me to school. They wouldn't advance me. They wouldn't pay me any more money. I was always fixing stuff because I could fix stuff. And they relied on my ability to fix anything. It didn't matter what it was. I fixed toilets in a dealership one time. And they didn't pay me anymore because it made more sense to send somebody who didn't know anything. So they didn't have to pay me more money and give me any value to anybody else. So me as a person, that's kind of the nuts and bolts of how I got to out of college and where I started. And beyond that, I've always been just a person who's been by himself. If you ask my dad, he would say, I've always been a person that's by myself, to myself. I drive across the country and don't listen to radio. Very, very many times in my life, found myself very lonely. And, you know, that was my own doing. I don't consider myself as somebody that's depressed because I don't get depressed. Depression's an excuse in my book. If you aren't making yourself happy, that's your own fault. But a lot of times my mind works a million miles a second. And if you really wanted to understand Fred Ashmore, understand that I'm having a conversation with you right now and I'm thinking about 400 other things. And so that's the way mind works all the time. So I could be building a truck in my head while I'm talking to you. And that a lot of times sits me as, I'm not going to say an outcast or a standout, but it makes me different usually from the people that I'm hanging around with. And that's where I've always had is an issue fitting in is I give everything 200% until the reciprocation gets to the point where it's all on my shoulders and there's no more help or there's no more interest or it's all put on me. So that's who I am really as a person. I like everyone. I don't hate anybody. And, you know, people might think I do, but I don't hate anyone. Hate's allowing somebody to live in your head rent-free. And you know, I don't do that. It takes up too much memory. And I'd rather save my memory for foolish car builds or dumb things I'm going to do. But, you know, I got had a child out of wedlock at 25, raised her as a single dad. And probably the best thing has ever happened to me. You know, I couldn't ask for a better kid. I did the best I could as a father, raised her, went and got custody of her on my own against an attorney. I represented myself, wound up having, you know, primary custody, primary residence. And when I was done with the attorney, he was paying me child support or they were paying me child support. So there's a certain amount of me that I consider myself articulate in the way that I build things, I think of things. I'll think of 1,000 ways to build something before I build it and while I'm building it. So I'll start building it and say like, oh, this might not have been the best idea. We may need to change this up. And as time went on, I always needed something in my off time, like my relationships. I had been in the past. I was always 100% in until the person wasn't 100% in anymore. And to me, I'm very, very lucky guy. I'm married now. My wife's a great lady. She sees the stuff I do and she's very supportive. And she, I told her the other day, I said, you know, if I had met you earlier, we probably wouldn't have been compatible, but we met each other at the right time where she was compatible to me and the things I was doing in life. And she's very supportive and we're friends. And she loves dogs. They just got home. So the thing is, that being said about her is we have a relationship that is very complementary of each other. And that's what I needed at this time in my life. So Fred Ashmore, let's think. Maybe I should do a 60-second round of Ask Fred. So loner, rebel, James Dean, I guess, but married, I guess maybe sums me up. Kind of Ken Miles in the racing world as far as, you know, you put it all out there, but you don't necessarily get along with everybody. And by no means am I saying I'm Ken Miles. I'm saying similar personalities in the realm of don't always go with the flow. Sometimes I'm the resistance in the river. So.
Well, it sounds like you're going to have a big banner on your tombstone that's going to say, Fred Ashmore, just do it.
Oh, Nike. With my luck, I get sued by Nike. It's going to, my epitaph is going to say, Fred, the four-letter F word. That's all it's going to say. Died.
Nice.
So, because that's usually what people say when I show up to an event or something. It's not Fred. It's the other four-letter F word because they know they're going to have their hands full in some capacity. So,
well, that's good. I'm glad. And I see you as a person and from what we've talked and what we've interacted with, it just seems like you are very much a just do it person.
Yes.
Try and figure out how to do it. If you don't know how to do it initially, you're going to figure out how to do it. And if you see something as a barrier, it's not a barrier. It's a hurdle.
Exactly.
And you're going to get over it. And that's what I've seen in you through all of our dealings lately.
I would call it a goal. Not so much mm-hmm. a hurdle, but a goal.
Sure. And that's very important. And all of those things seem to be what you're trying to do. And I applaud you for that. Talk to us about 2555.
2555.
How and where.
The how and where. 2555 was supposed to be 25 flat. Let's start with that. So I wanted it to be at the least 2530. And that's really where the whole thing starts. After the 2019 C2C, as a lot of people know, I was not a happy individual. Just a bunch of cloak and dagger BS being played with a bunch of people. I was tired of it because I'm a racer. I put my full heart into everything and I don't like rugs pulled out from under me. So 2555 became as a big middle finger to some of the stuff that had taken place over the last few years. It started with, you know, my wife and I went out to dinner with a cannonballer and his wife, and we were talking, and he said to me, he said, we had the conversation at the 2019 C2C, and the conversation was, you know, what would you break the record in? And I talked about a Charger and using a Charger, and then I looked at a Ford police car. As I was sorting things out, we were at dinner and he said, you know, you really need to break this record. This record is yours for the taking. I felt the record was obtainable. And it was a matter of, I started planning it out and started talking with my brother, the ifs, the whens, the wheres, what we were going to do it in. But then Gulf Shores happened in 2020, which is when I started talking to Fergie about the job for HGTV. We all got together. I cannonballed a bunch of lobster from Maine down to Gulf Shores and fed everybody lobster right off the shore of Maine all the way to Gulf Shores. I think it was a foolish time. We had a weekend down there, and I was just being Fred. I'm happy and go lucky. I never say no. I have fun, do whatever. And we got on some go-karts, and I put a whooping on them. And I mean a whooping, to the point where people were posting and people were asking, so who won the go-kart race? And they just said, ask Fred, because it was that bad. And things like that. And I'm a gamester. You know, I like to hoop it up. I like to have a good time and laugh and play and have fun. And I didn't realize there was any issue. You know, I just trying to bury the hatchet from 19 and move on. And apparently there was a lot more going on behind closed doors than I realized. And so, you know, we all went home, went our separate ways. And I was at Gulf Shores and they shut down the show. I got talking to Fergie and I said, I need to go to the dealership. And since I'm not going to run a Hellcat, I'm going to have to see if I can buy a Scat Pack charger. So I went right down to Gulf Shores Motors and I bought a brand spanking new Scat Pack charger. I had a choice between black and silver. And by the time I made my choice, the black one was gone. So I'm not going to say I stuck with silver because I love silver. And but I wanted it to look like a police car. And my brother and I had designed a way to refuel while the car was moving. So the idea was we were going to refuel the car. I was going to build a tank system to put in the back seat, and we were going to refuel the car while it was mobile. And that way to cut out stopping at all. I had it figured out where we could have a couple box trucks that would block traffic to keep them behind us while we refueled, and then we could take off. So we had it all planned out. We had that all set up, and I had, you know, signed the preliminary papers and stuff to purchase the car, and it was time for me to go home. I needed to get to Oklahoma. I wasn't sure if I could go to the Northeast, and it was time for me to start, you know, crunching the numbers, you know, getting the stops together, organizing people to help me with this, and I got a phone call, and that phone call changed everything. Changed everything Fred Ashmore has to do with Cannonball, that one phone call. And nobody seems to want to talk about the phone call, but a good friend of mine, and I told him at the time that I wouldn't disclose who told me or anything else. It's come out that a very good friend of mine, David Simpson, it's all out there now, so it's not being hidden. And Dave didn't call me a lot at the time. We knew each other, and well, let me do a little back history between David and I. So when I built the Galaxy, the one with the 200-gallon tank, Dave really did not like me. He thought I was an arrogant jerk. And he bet me for pink slips that I couldn't beat him across the USA. Lo and behold, I beat David across the USA. And jokingly, when he arrived at the Portofino, I had a cold Coors Light for him. And I said, you can park my frigging car over there. And so we laughed about it and we joked. And I just said, David, I don't want your car. It's gamesmanship. You know, I love the joke. I love stuff like that. And I kind of was like, why is David calling me? And he says to me, he goes, Fred, he goes, I wouldn't normally call you. He says that this is business. And I said, okay. I said, you know, what do you need? You need a hand with some cars, you know, need some stuff hauled. What's going on? And he said, it's about your run coming up. And I said, okay. I said, well, what's going on? And he said, well, he said, you know, there's some talk that people are going to call you in. Well, what do you mean? He said, well, you need to not tell anybody what you're running for a car or what you're driving or when you're doing it and anything else. And I said, well, you know, that's common sense. You don't tell anybody. I said, but, you know, I'm going to get some spotters and I'm going to, he said, Fred, I'm telling you, this isn't me just calling to talk to you. This is me telling you that there's some people in the community that do not like you. And it has been said out loud, the verbally, that if they can find out when you are doing your run, they are going to call the police on you. Like, I need to be told not to put it on my Facebook. I'm racing across the USA at 150 miles an hour from New York. I mean, do you really think that I don't know not to, you know, have a plane with a banner on the back saying Fred's cannonballing today? I was pissed off. And I said, who said it? And he said, I've told you this. This is all I can tell you. He said, it is a significant group of people in the cannonball community. That changes everything. It changes the whole dynamic, because at that point, I'm friends with everybody in the cannonball community, or so I thought. You know, I thought Gulf Shores kind of swept it under the rug. You know, we're all good. I had been at a cannonball party the night before I drove down, so I told everybody I was going to buy a new charger. You know, I really didn't know. I'm sitting here as a, like I said, I'm kind of a lone wolf. I'm kind of an odd man out. I'm sitting here trying to think of, and I've got a guy who's told me, you can't tell anybody, but I'm not going to tell you who you can't tell. And it's, so I'm stuck. I'm really stuck. You know, street racing has become a very big offense in the US. So when you have people who are out there doing the same exact thing, but they're going to call you in, that's a game changer. So now I've got a car I'm supposed to go back down Gulf Shores and pick up. I've got to call the car company because everybody knows I'm running a Dodge Charger. And now I've got one on my credit report because I'm supposed to go get it. So I got to call Gulf Shores and say, hey, sorry, not buying this Charger. And now I'm like, what can I buy? What can I use? What can I, you know, because at this point now, COVID's closed everything down. So dealers are pretty much not taking any stock, not seeing any customers. And I'm kind of like, what are my options? And
Fred, before we go any further, we know where this is going, but before our listeners find out where this is going, let's just do a quick recap. There's a record to be broken, and Fred Ashmore is setting his mind to do this. You're talking to a lot of the right people, so you think. You're in with the right people, so you think. You get to the point where I'm planning this right down to the car that you're going to do the run in. You get a little bit of news from a buddy that says you're in trouble to some degree by something somebody said. And now you've got to scrap everything to that point. And I can just imagine how pissed off you would have been. Like you said, you know, like now all of a sudden you've got a point to prove and you've got a job to do. But now you've got no car because you've had to cancel that sale. You don't want anyone to know what you're driving. Where do we go from here? What's the next step to planning this run? Where do you find a car? We know you enjoy the Get Out and Drive podcast. John, let our listeners know how they can support the show.
Well, you can buy the show a gallon of gas.
Please explain.
You've heard of Buy Me a Coffee, right?
Oh, yeah.
But who needs coffee? We need a gallon of gas. Just go to our website, getoutanddrive.com, scroll to the bottom of any screen, and you'll see the Buy Us a Gallon of Gas link. Just click, and you'll help to keep our show running.
Cruise on over to our website, getoutanddrive.com, for all the info you never wanted to know about our podcast. Hit us up on our listener hotline, be the first to know what's happening, get industry news, and grab your Get Out and Drive merch. Connect with us on social media. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. Follow us on Twitter at Get Out and Drive Pod.
What drives you?